Hello, sweet ones. I am fortunate to have such courageous listeners who write me on Facebook and ask to share their stories of adversity and how they found their inner strength to get past the most difficult times and make a more positive life for themselves. And I say courageous because that is what they are. Living is an act of courage. The courage to travel down an unknown road to find happiness. But unfortunately, some find that they're on the wrong road, or that the road is full of danger or despair. For those, they may find themselves in a state of depression or feel hopeless.
So back in the late 1970s, a good friend of mine named Adina Robleski lost her daughter. It was actually her stepdaughter, but really much more like a daughter to her. Lost her daughter to suicide. And at the time, nobody really talked about this anywhere, and she couldn't find any resources, any information. She didn't have anybody to talk to, and she felt the terrible stigma and shame of suicide that existed then and in part still exists today. She started talking about this very quietly and then far more publicly. She started doing research to understand suicide as much as she could. And then she started doing groups around the Twin Cities where she would offer opportunities for others who had lost people to suicide to come and talk about it, just very informally. She then brought together a group of five or six others who had lost someone to suicide, a daughter, a son, a spouse. And they decided to formalize an organization and call it SAVE, Suicide Awareness Voices of Education. And the goal was to really be able to put a voice to this issue of suicide. And she, Adina Robleski, was the first person to run the organization, although it was all volunteer-run for the first 10 years. And there was a board of directors and several volunteers. And then we unfortunately lost Adina to a brain tumor. And because I was friends with her, as a matter of fact, Adina and I used to talk about creating an organization like SAVE even before SAVE existed. We used to go to health fairs around the community and talk about, could there be something like this? And so since I was connected to Adina, and I had worked in hospitals and clinics where I brought SAVE in, it was a natural fit for me to come here and take over. It was a very small organization, really just a local organization, with the goal of building SAVE into a national organization with many programs and lots of things that could help people.
That was the CEO of SAVE, Dr. Daniel Rydenberg. SAVE was one of the nation's first organizations dedicated to the prevention of suicide. For 30 years, with more than 20 charters, SAVE has been the leading national organization working to prevent suicide through public awareness, education, and as a resource for suicide survivors. On their website's resources, save.org, is a list of suicide statistics, such as in 2020, 45,979 Americans died by suicide. There is one suicide death in the United States every 11.5 minutes. There are approximately 1,149,475 attempted suicides every year in the United States. Using a 25-to-1 ratio, or one attempt every 27.5 seconds. But I want you to keep in mind, each number represents a life. But one of the most surprising statistics I found is that women suffer depression twice as often as men, yet there are 3.9 male deaths by suicide for each female death by suicide. Why is that?
More males die by suicide than do females. We lose about 4 males to every 1 female. Females attempt suicide 3 to 4 times as often as do males. So we have more females attempting, more males dying. We know that in early adolescence, as the brain begins to change and as hormones change, for both males and females, it tends to result in far more depression for females during adolescence. And as that continues on into early adulthood and even throughout adulthood, women tend to talk about their feelings far more. They express their emotions more. They acknowledge them more than do males. It doesn't mean that males aren't really struggling with depression, because in fact we know that they do. It's just that they cover them up. Sometimes they cover them up by drinking. Sometimes it's through sports and more aggressive kinds of actions, and other gambling, things like that. But we know that both males and females experience episodes of depression. Females tend to be a little bit higher in adolescence. When you get into adulthood, it's pretty close to 1-to-1 prevalence across the country. But males, when they die by suicide, tend to and have historically used more lethal methods. They tend to gravitate towards firearms far more, or doing things that hurt themselves far more lethally than females have tended to gravitate towards less lethal means. Now, unfortunately, over the last 5, maybe 8 years or so, we've seen that start to change, and we've started to see females using more lethal methods. But still at this point in time, males die 4 times as often, females attempt 3-to-4 times as often, and we know that emotional issues definitely impact all of them.
Since COVID, has there been a shift in the demographics or the numbers of suicide?
Well, that's difficult to really know. In 2019, we had a small drop in suicides, which was right prior to the COVID pandemic. In 2020, we had a drop that was during COVID. The research isn't in yet to formalize exactly why. I suspect that it had to do with people being very intentional about being connected to people, increase in telemedicine and support systems that were available to people. But mostly it was about people being intentional about checking in on people who were struggling. Unfortunately, those 2 years of drops were... It's great that we had them. It's uncharacteristic. We've had rises really for the last 10 to 20 years in suicide rates. However, the provisional data that came out a few months ago this summer of 2022, the 2021 provisional data really showed an increase that overtook any of the declines that we had in the last 2 years. So while there was some decline in the early years of the pandemic, it has come right back. The projections are for the rest of 2021 and 2022 to be higher in terms of numbers of deaths by suicide. In terms of attempts, we definitely know that there's been an increase in reported attempts in hospitalizations, especially for youth. We also know that mental health challenges have really come to the surface a lot during the pandemic. And that's really across the age spectrum, not just relative to youth. Youth have really struggled, but it's also true for adults. So we've seen increases in thinking about suicide, some increases in attempts, and tragically some deaths, especially as we're seeing in the 2021 data.
From my own personal observations, I think that people still don't take depression or suicide as serious as they should until it hits close to home. I don't even think that many people know the signs of depression. Can you tell me what your website does and the resources you have available?
Sure. I mean, that is exactly one of the things that our website does. If you go to save.org, S-A-V-E.org, you can find information on there about mental health issues such as depression and some of the signs and symptoms. You can find out how to ask about suicide, what the warning signs are of suicide, the risk factors and the protective factors. So there's a wealth of information on there just about suicide and the whole concept around it. What we know is that There are a lot of people in our world that live with depression. In the United States, estimates are somewhere between 20 and 25 million Americans will live with a diagnosis of depression in any one year. Out of that 20 or 25 million, we are going to have about 46 or 47,000 deaths by suicide. And out of that 46 or 47,000 deaths by suicide, 50 to 60% of that are going to be as a result of depression. And it's not really depression alone, but depression will be a diagnosis that will be connected to that. So what that tells us is that you've got somewhere between 22 and 25,000 people a year that are dying by suicide that have some connection to depression. But you have 20 to 25 million living with depression. And what's really important for people to know and understand is that depression is an illness. Depression is an illness that most people live with and function with and survive and thrive through. For a small number of people, they don't, and we do lose them, or they struggle intensively. Depression happens to us in normal life events. Someone who is close to us dies of natural causes or aging or from some other illness, and people get sad and they get upset. They lose a pet, they get sad and they get upset. They lose a job. Just normal parts of life can cause depression, but most of us get through that, whether it's a few days or a few weeks, they get through that. But if you have symptoms of emotional dysregulation, where you're feeling so sad that you can't function, you can't go to work, you can't go to school, you're feeling so exhausted that you can't get out of bed, you have no energy, you have no interest in activities any longer, you don't find anything pleasurable, you don't want to eat anything, nothing seems to taste good, or you're crying quite a bit, you just want to sleep all the time. And then there's some, those are symptoms of depression. And then there's some that also think about suicide as they're depressed. These things, when they get wrapped up into this, I can't function any longer, I can't engage in social activities, work activities, family activities, that's when we get really concerned about a diagnosable place that somebody might really need to talk to somebody. They might need medications, they might need alternative types of therapy, they might need cognitive behavioral therapy, they might need lots of different things. But we know that the majority of people with depression, a disease that does hit far too many people, can live through it and never become suicidal. For a small number, it becomes very, very high risk of life and death.
Do you think that there is enough awareness of the signs of depression and having the tools to help somebody considering suicide?
Really good question. When it comes to the warning signs about suicide and whether or not people display them, this is really hard, and it's really hard for those who are survivors of suicide loss, when they've lost someone to suicide, because we know that the majority of people that die by suicide did exhibit some warning signs. The problem is that they don't do it very clearly or directly for people. So, for example, they don't come right out and say, I'm going to go take my life tomorrow at 2 o'clock in this way at this place. They're not that clear about it. They may say things far more disguised, like, everybody in my family would be better off if I wasn't around, or my team at work would be doing better if I wasn't here. And we don't see that as a warning sign. We don't necessarily see them looking for ways to die, and yet we know that the people who do die by suicide look for ways to die. People that are suicidal talk about feeling hopeless. They talk about having no sense of purpose any longer, no reason to be alive any longer. When we hear some of those things, the trouble is that the people that are suicidal don't tell all of us all of those things. They might tell one person one thing, and another person in another community, another state, another thing. And so it's very hard to put the pieces of the puzzle together of the warning signs that somebody might be suicidal.
Are the signs of depression different for people based on their age demographics, such as are the signs in teens different than somebody in their 40s, for example?
When it comes to are the warning signs the same for adults and for youth, some do overlap quite a bit. Communicating their intent to die, whether it's directly or more indirectly, as I mentioned, they do that. What's different about a sense of hope and that sense of hopelessness is it's pretty common that adults will face times in their life where they feel kind of hopeless. But for a young person to talk about having no hope and no future when their whole life is out in front of them, that's a pretty significant warning sign. So we do see some differences between adults and youth. There are a number of overlaps. You can find the warning signs for suicide on our website at save.org. And we actually built a specific warning sign just for youth suicides that anybody can find at youthsuicidewarningsigns.org.
I know as a teacher, we always had meetings on how to recognize gang activity, but we never had a meeting to recognize if a student is showing signs of depression. How do we begin these conversations in the school setting?
So it's a really interesting question in terms of, you know, how do we get more conversation, more dialogue going on about this in our communities, in our schools, in our workplaces, and how do we support that, even financially, but even with the expertise to be able to do that? These are challenging questions. There is far more conversation about mental health issues and suicide-related issues today than there was 2 years ago, definitely more than 5 and 10 years ago, definitely more than when Adina Robleski thought of the idea around SAVE back in the early 1980s. Far more conversation about that. And the pandemic has really, kind of added to that, that people need to talk about these issues. So we are seeing young people talk about these issues far more. We're seeing some adults. We still really struggle to get schools to be interested in talking about this. We at SAVE, I developed an evidence-based program for schools, for high schools, called LEADS, which is Linking Education and Awareness of Depression and Suicide. We wanted to retest that on schools across the country. We reached out to over 50 schools across the country of all different sizes and shapes and all different communities. And the schools were just not interested. The schools were far more focused on academics and trying to get the kids back after the pandemic than integrating a three-hour suicide prevention curriculum. So some of it is just that, is we've got to get schools to understand that where kids are is a workplace for them, and that is where they spend the bulk of their time, and that's where many people are seeing them, far more than even when they go at home. So we need schools to better understand this. I created a set of best practices for schools, key concepts that teachers need to learn. We do that training. We've done it here and in other parts of the country. But it's very slow to get schools very interested in wanting to do that. Part of the issue is around money and politics, honestly. If a school identifies a young person needing mental health care, the law requires that the school has to pay for that, and most schools don't want to do that. Especially there are situations across this country where families don't have insurance, and so when a school identifies that there might be a mental health challenge for a student, then the school is on the hook to pay that bill, and schools just don't have those kinds of resources, especially with the need as great as it is. So we need more training of teachers. We need more just public conversation about this. We need more students to be able to talk about this freely without fearing that they're going to get in trouble or it's going to get back to their parents or they're going to be sent to a hospital when they might not need that. And we need more funding at a federal level, at a state level, and at a local level. We need communities to invest more in all of these things to make sure that the young people today get the services that they need. And it's true also at the adult level. If we actually look at the numbers of people who die by suicide in this country, out of 46 or 47,000, the vast majority of people that are dying are adults. They're middle-aged adults. The second highest group in terms of numbers are senior citizens. Really, it's those 65 and older and 85 and older. That's the second highest number of people dying. Young people that are 15 to 24 are the lowest number of people that are dying. They're the ones that get a lot of the media attention. They get a lot of the outpouring of emotional support when there's a crisis or when we lose someone. someone, but they're the smallest number. So if we look at out of the 46,000 deaths, 6,000 being youth, that means 40,000 are adults. So we need to make sure that not only do our schools and our teachers and our parents have information around those 6,000, that's a lot of youth, that a lot of lives, years lost. We need to also make sure that this happens in workplaces and in homes for adults.
If you were in elected office, what legislation would you introduce for suicide prevention and awareness?
Well, there's so many things in, legislatively that we could do. All the states across the country need funding to support 988, the National Suicide Prevention, National Suicide and Emotional Crisis Line. So we need funding to support the crisis centers that are taking the calls, the texts, and the chats. For adults and for youth that are reaching out for help. So we need funding for the 988. We need funding for training. We need legislative level funding and mandating of training for healthcare professionals, whether you're talking about doctors in emergency departments, nursing staff, social workers, psychologists, nursing. We need mandated training and funding to support that, as well as teachers in schools.
With my magazine, Know the Issues with Lisa Vallone, I highlighted a bill in South Carolina where they wanted to have each student ID have a suicide prevention number on it. Is this a good idea? And is this enough?
This issue has come up in many states around putting the National Lifeline logo and phone number on student IDs. It's a great idea, and there's nothing wrong with it. Do I think that we absolutely have to have that? No, I think that's an adult response to a youth issue. As adults, I think we think that a young person's going to look at their badge and think that's the number to call. A young person is just going to go onto their phone, and they're going to know the information already, or they're going to just Google it. So do we need to put a lot of time and energy and money into mandating something like that? Again, it's not a bad thing. Doing anything to raise awareness and reduce stigma around this, improve access and let people know where to go and how to get access to it, that's not a bad thing. It just wouldn't be my first priority of where we'd be spending money. We also need to definitely increase bed capacity in hospitals. There needs to be a lot of funding to support that. Designated units, even psychiatric and behavioral health units in hospitals, there's very few beds available, so we need to do things around that for people. Financial support for those that either don't have insurance or don't have enough insurance to be able to get the care that they need. So again, increasing access to support would be some of the top priorities for me if I were in that kind of role.
What is 988?
For the last 17 or 18 years, the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline has been providing suicide prevention care and support for people who would call the Lifeline. That number was 800-273-TALK, 800-273-8255, and while the number still exists, it's not being promoted any longer, and we don't talk about it any longer, because in July of this year, July 14th of 2022, the federal government rolled out 988. 988 is a very easy number to remember, and it's been a broadened number, so it's not just around suicide crisis, although it is a suicide and emotional crisis line. Very similar to 911, but for an emotional related situation, not necessarily something that you would call 911 for. We know that there's some real benefits to having a national number like this. Not only is it easy to remember, especially for people who are in a psychological crisis, a long number is hard to remember, especially the number that it used to be. But not everybody that calls the 911 needs police response. And in some populations, in some communities, for example, the African American community, the Native American community, having police response isn't a good response. So having 988, which gets people to trained counselors that can help them navigate through whether or not they need to go to a hospital or whether they just need a referral to a mental health crisis response, is a much much better system. Now, it's going to take some time, actually, for us to build 988 into what 911 is. It took about 20 or 25 years for 911 to become what it is and what it's known for and how it responds and to be running as efficiently as it does. 988 is brand new. It's a mere matter of months old. So we have capacity issues that we're addressing. We have training issues that we're addressing, standardization issues across the system. There's funding issues for 988. There are a host of other issues that are going to take some time for it to roll out, but this is federally legislated, and the FCC has designated 988 for this new line, and it does provide really quick and easy access to people who need that care.
What do you think is the scariest part about starting a conversation about suicide awareness and prevention?
I think the one thing is that I think when it comes to this issue, it is so scary to people, and they don't think that they're the ones to be involved, so they don't ask the question. They want to believe it's somebody else, or they want to believe it's some other doctor somewhere, or something like that. And the reality is that we don't have enough doctors, we don't have enough psychologists to be able to help, and they're not always accessible, especially in remote areas. We need everybody to understand that we all have a role to play in suicide prevention. We can all be good listeners. We can all be compassionate people. And people need to know that asking somebody about suicide doesn't increase their risk. We have a lot of research that tells us it doesn't increase their risk. It doesn't lead them down that path. In fact, it might be the thing that saves their life. So everybody needs to be able to know that they can do it and they have to do it when somebody's at risk. If you were walking down the street and you saw somebody having a seizure, or you having somebody who was choking or somebody that might be having a heart attack, you'd do something. When it comes to an emotional crisis or a suicide-related crisis, we all have to do something to save somebody's life. We can't be afraid of it. We have to be active and engaged, and that is what's going to save people's lives. So it's not just something we send to a hospital or we have somebody else deal with. This is a problem for all of us. It's one of the leading causes of death in our country and in the world for young people. So it takes all of us to save lives, and everybody can do that.
I think the key here is to remember that this is a disease. It's not something that is criminal. It's not something to be embarrassed about. Everyone gets sick physically at some time. It's also natural that everyone gets sick mentally as well. And yet, when somebody tries to commit suicide, when somebody is in severe depression, they feel at times like the walls of conversation are closed to them. No one wants to acknowledge it. No one wants to talk about it. They may even trivialize it. Or, if somebody attempts suicide, they are treated like a criminal. I think that we need to start reframing these conversations so that people know that this is a disease, and that people should be treated with respect and given the conversations and the resources that they need so they could get better.
Yes, we need people to understand that this is a brain illness. This is something that happens to the brain, and the body gets sick, and the brain can get sick. It doesn't mean that it can't be treated, because it can. Most of the time, we can get people through these crises, and they can go on to lead a full life. For every one person that we lose to suicide, you might have 20 or 25 attempts. We have about 275 people that survive. For every person who dies, 275 will go on to live. That have thought about it, made a plan about it, or attempted, 275. So we need to pay attention to both, because there is a risk of contagion for people when somebody dies, especially within families or close people to somebody who's died. And we don't want to ever forget those that we've lost. I've lost 6 patients of mine to suicide. I've lost a family member and a friends to suicide. We don't want to forget them. We want to pay attention to them, and we want to honor them and pay tribute to them in their lives. We also need to pay attention to those who live with mental health issues, and they struggle with them, but they survive and they thrive through that. And they shouldn't be stigmatized because of a brain illness. We don't stigmatize other illnesses. We shouldn't stigmatize any mental health illness at all. And definitely we shouldn't stigmatize suicide or those who have died by suicide.
And so, sweet one, I hope that they gave you some awareness and some resources that you can use. And if you are somebody who is struggling with depression or want to reach out and talk to someone, there are so many sources that can help you. And one of them is going to save.org. On that site, not only do you find the hotline number 988, but you'll find so many other resources, such as a quiz where you could self-evaluate your level of depression. And if you're somebody who has gone through this in life and you want to share your story with others, a story that will help to give positive light to those who are in a dark time, I ask you to reach out to me on Facebook at The Power of Me Today. Or alternatively, you can reach me at my other podcast, knowtheissueswithlisavallone@gmail.com. I know that's a lot, so it's knowtheissueswithlisa, and then Vallone is spelled V as in Victor, A-L-L-O-N-E, @gmail.com. Please, if you're somebody who needs help, don't wait to reach out. There are people who can help you, but you have to take the first step. And I know how hard this has been to hear, and so I'm going to read you a story that I hope will help bring some calm into your life. And this one is called The Foolish, Timid Little Hare, which is an East Indian fable. Once upon a time, there was a foolish, timid little hare who was always expecting something awful to happen. She was forever saying, "Suppose the earth were to crack and swallow me up. Oh dear me, just suppose. Just suppose." She said this over and over again, till at last she had really believed the earth was about to crack and swallow her up. One day, she was asleep under a palm tree when some monkeys above dropped down a coconut. As soon as the little hare heard the noise, she jumped up and cried, "Oh dear me, the earth is surely cracking." And then she ran away as fast as she could, without ever looking behind her. Presently, she met an older hare who called out after her, "Why are you running so fast?" The foolish, timid little hare answered, "The earth is cracking and I'm running away so as to not be swallowed up." "Is that it?" cried the second hare. "Dear me, then I will run away too." And off he dashed beside her. And soon they met another hare. They told him the earth was cracking, and off he dashed beside them. So it went on until, at last, there was 100,000 hares all running away as fast as they could. By and by, the hares met a deer. "Why are you all running so fast?" asked the deer. "The earth is cracking," they wailed. "We're running away so as to not be swallowed up." "The earth is cracking. Oh dear me," said the deer. And she bounded after the crowd as fast as she could go. A little further on, they passed a tiger. "Why are you all running so fast?" called the tiger. "The earth is cracking," the fearful ones wailed, "and we're running away so as to not be swallowed up." "The earth is cracking," howled the tiger, and he sprang away after the crowd as fast as he could go. In a few minutes, they met an elephant. "Why are you all running so fast?" asked the elephant. "The earth is cracking," the fearful ones wailed, "and we're running away so as to not be swallowed up." "The earth is cracking? Oh dear me," trumpeted the elephant, and he lumbered off after the crowd as fast as he could go. At last, the wise King Lion saw the animals running, head over heels in a crazy crowd. And he heard one of them cry, "The earth is cracking." Then he ran out boldly before them and roared three times until they halted. "What is this that you are saying?" he cried. "O king," they answered, "the earth is cracking. We'll all be swallowed up." "The earth is cracking," roared the King Lion. "Hoity-toity, wait a minute. Let's just take time to find out if such a thing could be true. Who was it that saw the earth crack? I pray you, tell me." "Not I," said the elephant. "Ask the tiger. He must have seen a crack, for it was he who told me." "Not I," said the tiger. "Ask the deer. She must have seen a crack, for it was she who told me." "Not I," said the deer. "Ask the hares. They must have seen a crack, for it was they who told me." So every single animal said he had not been the one to see the earth crack, and he pointed out someone else who had told it to him. Thus King Lion came at last to the hares, and the hares all pointed to that one foolish, timid little hare who stood by shivering and shaking, more afraid than ever before. "She told us," they all cried. And then the lion said, "Little hare, what made you say that the earth was cracking?" "I heard it crack," said the hare. "You heard it?" asked the lion. "Where did you hear it crack?" "By the big palm tree. I was fast asleep, and I woke up and thought, oh dear me, suppose the earth should crack and swallow me up. And just then I heard a cracking noise as loud as thunder, and away I ran as fast as I could." "Well then," said the lion, "you and I will go back to the place where the earth is cracking and see what is the matter." "No, no, no," cried the foolish, timid little hare. "I would not go out there again for anything in the world." "But," said the lion, "I will take you on my back." So at last the foolish, timid little hare got up on the lion's back, and away they went like the wind till they came to the palm tree. No sooner had they arrived than they heard a loud thud. The monkeys threw down another coconut, and there it was at last. At last the hare understood how nothing but a falling coconut had made her think that the earth was cracking. So the foolish, timid little hare went back to the other animals, and she stood up before them all and said, "The earth is not cracking." "Well, well, well," said the elephant, "you don't say. So the earth is not cracking after all." And he turned around and lumbered off. "Well, well, well," said the tiger. "So the earth is not cracking." And he turned around and trotted off. Thus, every one of the animals turned around and went back into the forest. And that was the end of the earthquake. I know that I am someone that even the smallest of things might, in my mind, turn out to be much bigger than they are. And I may worry about it so much more than I need to. When if I had actually reached out to someone, they could have put it into perspective for me. They could have calmed me and helped me. And so, no matter what it is that you are experiencing, if you feel that it is too much for you, if it feels like you are retreating from life, if it feels like you need to talk to someone, please do so. No one will judge you. In fact, just the opposite. They know how much courage it takes to come forward and ask for help. I do hope that you do find the courage if you need it. And again, if you have a story to share that could help my listeners, please reach out to me. And until then, good night.